Habakkuk. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand if you've ever read it or studied through it. We're entering into what some people might call the black hole of the Old Testament. And you actually do see this. I would imagine that if we know much about the prophets, we know about Isaiah, we know about Jeremiah, we may know something about Ezekiel, we know about Daniel, but when it comes to some of the minor prophets, like Habakkuk, most of us don't know much, if we know anything at all. It's something to be concerned about, because it's not only true for people in the pews, it's also true for people in the pulpits, people in seminaries. We see it continually on the examining committee. The guys that come, their weakest area is always in the minor prophets. They know the least about them. They know the least about what they taught. And they know very little about how we can actually take what they spoke and apply it to the contemporary church and to ourselves today. This book is very applicable. And I hope over this time that we're going to understand how and why it is. First of all, I want to challenge you with the idea it's not kind of called a minor prophet because it's a minor thing to God. It has nothing to do with it, with the message being minor or the prophet himself being minor or anything. It only has to do with the length of the prophecies that we have recorded here. Three short chapters. This is a very interesting book for a lot of reasons, and one of those is it's not even a typical book of prophecy. If you think about Isaiah and you think about Jeremiah, you're going to remember that very often you see this expression, "Thus saith the Lord." This is what God says. The interesting thing about this particular book is it really is a dialogue between God and Habakkuk. In a sense, a conversation that takes place. So it's presented in a way that you don't typically find even the prophetic books being presented in. We don't know much about this fella. As a matter of fact, he's not mentioned anywhere else in Scripture. So we don't know exactly when he was born or what the circumstances were of his birth or if he was married and had children or you know what. We don't know anything about Habakkuk at all. We can't definitively say when and actually these prophecies were written down. However, knowing something about history, more than likely, they took place in the historical context between the fall of the Assyrian Empire and the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C., roughly about a 24-year period, 610 B.C. to 586 B.C. We think we've honed it in to that period. Why? It's because of the things that are talked about fit into this whole picture historically. What was going on there? Well, it was near the end of the southern kingdom of Judah. Remember when the kingdom divided in the northern kingdom, which continued to be called Israel, and the southern kingdom was known as Judah? When did the division take place? It took place immediately after Solomon. So the only two people that ever ruled over Israel as a whole were David, and David didn't need to do that for his whole monarchy for a while. He reigned over Judah only, but then eventually Israel was united under him, and then it remained united under Solomon. But in the days of Rehoboam, his son, immediately the kingdom divided into two parts, Israel to the north and Judah to the south. If you studied anything about the kings that are described in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, you know some basic things. And one of those is that there were very few shining lights. There were quite a few mediocre kings, and there were lots of very wicked and evil kings, both in the north and eventually in the south as well. If we are right historically, then the king who was reigning went by the name of Jehoiachin. Ever hear of that name? One of the very last kings of Judah. He happened to be the son of Josiah. Now, if you know anything about the kings in Judah, as far as good kings go, you probably already know this, that Josiah is recognized as being one of the very best kings, one of the greatest kings that Judah ever had. The interesting thing is he comes right near the very end of the kingdom. But he brought about religious reforms. And he was a case where the apple didn't fall close to the tree because his father, Manasseh, is considered to be one of the worst kings ever, one of the most wicked and most evil men that ruled on the throne. So Josiah was an exception. Unfortunately, Jehoiachin, his son, did not follow after his father. He didn't follow in his father's footsteps. He basically undid every good thing that his father, Josiah, had done in his lifetime. He returned Judah back to the state that Josiah had founded in when he became king. During his reign, Judah plunged into a period of darkness that was unprecedented at that point. That is the historic period that we find these prophecies placed in. So read with me, if you would. Verse 1, the burden... Some translations say oracle, that Habakkuk the prophet saw. I prefer burden. Because we understand this to be, this message that we're going to work our way through here is not what people would be just saying, that's a really good message. It's so exciting that I can't wait to get it out to all the people to hear the same, to hear what I've just heard. You need to understand that's not the kind of a message we're going to get from this book. It's basically the same message that Jeremiah prophesied, and understand that Jeremiah and Habakkuk were contemporaries. And they were saying the same thing. The message was basically the same, given it in a little different means, but the same message. The people of God, in part, a large part, have turned away from the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. The people who were called the chosen people of God, the people who went by the name of God, the people in Jerusalem, and the temple was there in Jerusalem, and things have degraded to the point now that they have taken pagan idols and they're worshiping idols in the very temple of God. Ezekiel is a contemporary too. He just happened to be in Babylon. In other words, it's a burden in the sense that it will wrench the heart of people who hear it. Would we think, because of that, that it would have been popular in the days of Habakkuk? No. Called a nabi. Prophet. When appointed by God to be a spokesperson. The root of that word actually means things like to pour forth or to boil forth. I think the best expression of it, to help us understand what is going on here, when God gives the title of prophet to a person, this is what it comes to. These are the words of Jeremiah. If I say I will not remember him or speak any more in his name, then my heart, it becomes like a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I am weary of holding it in, and I cannot endure it. The words of a true prophet who spoke the word of God, even though it was a word that wrenched his heart in doing it. Can remember the words of Moses all the way back in Deuteronomy chapter 18. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from among your countrymen. You shall listen to him. The Lord said, I will raise up a prophet, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak all that I command him. Not just what they like, not just what they want, but everything he says. Again, this message was not a popular one. Jeremiah was not a popular prophet. He was persecuted very greatly because one of the things that was going on in his day and had been going on for ever since God had done this, because God, when he talks about, and Moses talks about raising up a prophet, he also gives them the ability or the means they could use to determine whether a prophet was a true prophet or a false prophet. That was basically if their message came through, if what they said came to reality, then they were a prophet. But if it did not, then they were false prophets. And we need to understand something. If you look at the biblical context here and consider things, it seems as though there was an overwhelming number of false prophets in the middle, or a few true prophets in the middle of a sea of false prophets. The message of the false prophets was designed to tickle the ears of people, to make them feel all warm and cozy inside and comfortable. The message of Jeremiah and Habakkuk and others like them grated on people. They refused to listen. They refused to react. At least in a godly fashion. You need to understand something, that there was a reason that God sent forth Habakkuk with this message, and one of those reasons was this, was to humble people, to break proud and arrogant people. An interesting thing here too is this, is it seems as though even though the prophet heard these words, God also showed him. This is the burden that Habakkuk saw. Not just one he heard, he saw it. When we read Hebrews chapter 1:1, it says this, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many ways, in many portions and in many ways. We need to understand that God spoke to these prophets in different ways. He spoke to Moses face to face. A lot of what he revealed to Daniel, he revealed in dreams. Other prophets saw visions. So we need to understand that Habakkuk was not just hearing, but there was a sense in which he was also seeing what God was talking about, what God was about to do is what it comes down to. And seeing the message and knowing the message and hearing the message. It tore his heart. Remember Paul in Romans talks about how that he would give up his salvation if he might possibly save some of the Jews. I would not be surprised if Habakkuk's idea or understanding or feeling about it was the same thing. Then follows the prophet's first complaint. There are a couple of complaints registered. This is the first one. Until when, Lord, must I call out for help, but you do not listen? Cry out to you, violence, but you do not save. In other words, I'm weary, Lord. I've cried to you, I've called to you, I've begged you, I've been down on my knees before you. But there's no response. There's no response at all. You've done nothing. Do you sometimes feel like your prayers fall on deaf ears? Sometimes you, and there are prayers that I know that you've been praying for years and years and years and years, and there actually probably are some prayers that you prayed for years and years and you finally gave up the praying because you didn't see anything happening. We need to be very careful in drawing the conclusion when we find ourselves in that situation of assuming that because he has not heard or he has not reacted, to assume that he just flat doesn't care. Habakkuk, in a sense, is saying, I would have gotten more responsive if I was talking to a brick wall or a solid rock or a tree than I've gotten from you. As much as I've come to you, as much as I cried out to you, as much as I've bared my very heart to you. There's a great sense in which our culture today is really letting our children down. I read an article just this week. Maybe some of you saw it. It had to do with this guy. He's a doctor. Works in an emergency room, I think is what he said. But he's talking about how he's had to deal with parents and children as they brought their child into the emergency room for them to treat because they fell and they need stitches in their head or something like that. And how he just sees over and over again, there is no discipline on the part of the parent. The parent makes no decisions. They let the children make all the decisions. We're destroying our children by setting them up like that. What would we think of a parent whose child came crawling or crying out to them in fear and confusion and did absolutely nothing? What would we think of that father? What would we think of that mother? Everywhere the prophet turns, as he goes down the streets of Jerusalem, around every corner, there is nothing but violence. Violence unchecked. Nothing seems to be right. Everything seems to be turned upside down. Morality has gone out the window. He's seen this violence and he's cried out to God. that the violence not only continues, the violence escalates. It gets worse. And it's been over a roughly a 300-year period that wickedness and evilness crept in. And Judah has been progressively going downhill ever since then. In other words, when we're looking at the people that Jehoiachin was ruling over and what the prophet's seeing, he's seeing some of the grossest moral corruption conceivable that has ever taken place. People were chasing after idols. Like we said before, they even brought their idols and set them up in the temple of God where they were supposed to worship. That was the place that God met people on earth. We were reading this morning, you may have picked up on this. Some people were sacrificing children to these pagan gods in the temple of God. And sometimes they were their very own kids. Can you imagine? Sexual promiscuity is everywhere. Dishonest scales are all over the marketplace. People are taking advantage of widows and orphans. Parents are not being parents to their children. It's an example of this, guys, is as religion decays, so does life. Very often you would get the idea the prophets were very lonely people. Not many people hanging around with them. We don't even know if Jeremiah and Habakkuk were even familiar with each other and knew each other. The life of a true prophet in those days was very lonesome. Why, Lord, do you not save us from this wicked generation? You need to understand something. One thing that's going on here is that age-old thing, and that is, why do the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer? That's what's going on. I saw a graph on Facebook the other day. It was very sobering. And sometimes when you get things on Facebook, you wonder if they're right, and I would rejoice if this was really wrong. Unfortunately, I don't think it is. It had to do with abortion. And it was just a big circle that had different colors on that circle, pie-shaped colors. Based upon how many died by particular wars, how many men died in the Civil War, how many men died in the World War I and World War II and stuff like that. You look at it, it looks like a circle, and there's a little teeny tiny, almost insignificant wedge out of that circle because all of that jointly is being compared to the number of children that have died at the hands of the abortionists. $60 million or so. You understand that we're talking about a fifth or a quarter of the population of the United States today to abortion. I mean, who would have ever thought? Who would have ever dreamed that something like this would take place in the good old U.S. of A., where we have all these freedoms and all these rights that are protected by this thing we call the Constitution. Something has definitely gone wrong. Not just a little wrong, a whole bunch wrong. We understand that the culture of the United States today is very different than the one that was around when we grew up as children. Most of us are older. That's not to say that things used to be perfect. And that's not to say that there weren't things that need to be taken care of. But there was a much greater sense of the presence of God and Jesus being central to everything. What I would say to you guys is what we're experiencing in the United States today is exactly what they were experiencing in Judah. And this is what happens when people turn their back on God and walk away from Him. As a nation. What about the church itself? How much has it changed in the last 50 years? Sometimes you wonder in our day if the world hasn't had more influence on the church than the church has had influence on the world. Superficial faith is run amok. You could walk down the street in Dunellen today and stop people and ask them if they knew Jesus and you know, if they knew they were saved. The vast majority of them would tell you they do. That when we look at the culture around us, is that possible? When we look at the evil that's creeping back into the church itself, can we know that that's at all possible? I'm telling you guys, you don't believe me. You think I'm lying to you. There are churches that go by the title church that are meeting right now while we're meeting, and the people will not hear the gospel. And in fact, they have never heard the gospel the whole time they've attended that so-called church. And we're not talking about just one or two. We're talking about, unfortunately, it could be the majority of churches. They do not preach and teach the gospel of Jesus Christ. Most people in the church today have not a clue when you start talking about things like grace and mercy and predestination and election and things like that. They're so clearly taught in the Bible. Most people in churches today are very satisfied to stay with the milk and never ever delve into the deeper things of God. There's a sense in which the church has to be taught over and over again. Because people just don't learn. Remember, every single one of those little children that have died horrible deaths was made in God's image. So can we possibly think for one second that God's pleased with it? I mean, forget about everything else. There's all kinds of things we could talk about here. I don't think there's a greater evil in our land. I honestly don't. And all for one reason, and that's just because they just happen to be inconvenient. That's the only reason ever. They're not wanted. We're hearing all this uproar today about black lives count. Well, you betcha they do. What about these little babies? Don't their lives count? Why do you make me see injustice? Let me ask you something. Have you seen any injustice lately? If you're like me, you're starting to wonder if justice is ever served anymore. It's like the courts have lost their blooming minds. They're siding against the people they should be siding with. People having to close businesses because they refuse to do wedding cakes for gay couples. Would you say that's an injustice? Lori and I saw 13 Hours last week. It has to do with Benghazi. If you have a weak stomach, don't go. But the people who were there, who experienced it, they said that this movie is very realistic. It tells the true story. And it's one of those times where you'll be very proud to be an American. But at the same time, you'll be sick to your stomach. Because they had to stand on their own. No one there. I am firmly convinced at this time, and this is one of the things I'm really struggling with, is I'm convinced that we should never, ever elect a president who has no military experience at all. Isn't it ridiculous that we take someone that doesn't know anything about the military, they've never experienced, they've never had no training in it or anything like that, and all of a sudden we make them the person in charge of it? Isn't that asinine? It's stupid. Dumb. We were having a heated discussion at Presbytery years ago. And the reason was this, is we had a guy come in for ordination. He had been issued a call by one of the PCA churches in the area, but he had not attended a PCA church. He had attended a Reformed church. And when he graduated from seminary, that Reformed church had ordained him. And he was being brought by the church with their desire that Presbytery would approve of that appointment. But let me tell you, that appointment came, but it didn't come very easily. Because we saw a formula for disaster. Because he had no internship. He had no training in ministry at all. He went to seminary and that was it. Whammo, bammo. And now he's going to become the lead pastor in an established church. He was going to be things like the moderator of the session, and he had never even been to a session meeting. And guess what happened? It didn't work. It didn't take much time at all that it didn't work. We could all say, why do you make me see injustice? Because we see it all the time. Is God tolerating wrong? Well, we know he could bring an end to it at any moment, right? So there is a sense in which he's tolerating and he's allowing it to happen. Is he taking pleasure and joy in it? No. No way. Destruction and violence. People are being attacked on the streets in America today. Unprecedented ways. Strife and conflict abounds. If we don't know that, let me tell you something. If you don't know that's true, then you're just flat blind. You're living in a hole. You're living in a cave. You got a bucket over your head. You got your ears stopped up and your eyes covered so you can't see. It's everywhere. And it seems to be growing. Why? Because so many people are not even aware that there is a prophecy that goes by Habakkuk. And the rest of the Bible that surrounds it. Therefore, the law was paralyzed and justice does not prevail. There are conversations taking place today on a national political level. They're just mind-blowing. Let me tell you, it's a refreshing thing to go to General Assembly because we're not talking about whether we should ordain homosexuals or whether we should do homosexual marriages and things like that. We don't talk about those things because the Bible's so clear about it, there's no question. The whole purpose of the law is to bring justice. The whole purpose of our Constitution is to establish law. So explain to me why we're having conversations that anybody's even talking about making Sharia law valid in the United States. Isn't that incredible? You need to understand it's not all bad. It does encourage people to live morally. But at the same time, men are permitted to beat their wives into submission. They're permitted to commit mercy killings when someone of their people converts to Christianity. How could that ever fit in with the Constitution of the United States? It's anti-constitutional. Crazy thing, guys, is there are people in jail today for abusing animals. Because they committed animal abuse. They're in jail. But they can abuse their wife. They can abuse their children, so on and so on and so on. And people just, that's just it. You got to live with it. Things are just bad. They're turned upside down and backwards. Things don't work like they used to. I mean, how can you have a law of justice if you have a different standard for different people? What would they do with me if I killed my wife? Heaven forbid. I would either be executed or spend the rest of my lifetime in prison, right? But now it's legal for some people to do it, but it's not legal for other people to do it. How can that be? How can we have double standards? That's a formula for injustice. It's the definition of injustice. Again, one of the things that was going on in Habakkuk's day and still continues today is this, as we look at God and we say, why is it? Why is it? This is the most frustrating thing I see. And that is that these wicked, awful, terrible people, they prosper. We have a culture today with a privileged class sitting on top of everybody else. One rule for them and a different rule for other people. What do you think would happen to a clerk if they got caught doing some of the things that some of our more prominent political people have been caught doing? We know that matter-of-factly. They've lied. They deceived. They've done this over and over and over again. And you and I sit here and we doubt seriously that anything of significance is going to happen to them. But what if they had been a little clerk sitting in some office doing the same sort of thing? What would have happened to them? We have people in high places today, my brothers and sisters, that belong in prison for what they've done, crimes they've done, and they're crimes that people know they've done, but they're part of the privileged class. And it doesn't apply to them. How many servant leaders do we have that lead according to the rule of Christ? And that is that when you are a leader, you are first and foremost a servant. You are there to serve the people that you represent, not yourself. So, we have every reason to be depressed, right? Well, let me tell you guys, above all people, the realistic look at the situation today, we should be the ones who have the most hope. Because we know as bad as the world makes things and as people, wicked people in the world and make things, that God can always turn the boat around, right? So what I'm telling you is we have reason to be optimistic. Really, nobody else on the face of the planet does. They look at things honestly, unless they happen to be one of the elitist class, and they look at it from a totally different perspective. If you happen to be the majority of people who are down below, if you didn't have Jesus in your life, you'd have really no reason at all to hope that things were going to get better. Remember, wickedness and evilness came to a head. The cross of Calvary. Jesus broke the back of death itself when he rose from the dead. Don't think for a minute that even though you've cried out to God over and over again about certain things and he hasn't answered, don't give up. Don't think for one minute that he just doesn't care. He cares about all of those things far more than you do. But remember, as we were studying through Matthew, everything that happened in the life of Jesus, absolutely every detail, was absolutely essential. And as much as we don't want to hear this kind of thing, everything that is being worked out today is also working out ultimately for the glory of God. The fact of the matter is the message of the gospel is what this world around us today needs desperately to hear. And if it's not hearing it, then shame on us. It's also exactly the message that the people living in Habakkuk's day needed. Sometimes it's so easy for us to focus on the sins of other people because we've all been sitting here today thinking about how terrible that person must be for doing that. That's awful. I would never do that. How could you possibly do something like that? Nah, 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 nah. And the truth is this, is we've all committed very wicked and evil acts against God and against other people. There is no squeaky clean person here. We're not going to find a squeaky clean person for president. But if we elect someone that we don't have a good sense of their salvation and their understanding of who Jesus is and their desperate need for him and all that stuff, the gospel, we might as well throw our vote down the toilet. It's not a popularity contest, guys. It's not who's most popular. It has to do with who is most founded. And not just in their religion, but in Christianity. I don't know if I said this to you before or not, but I mentioned this maybe last week or the week before that, is Richard Dawkins. If you know anything about Richard Dawkins, he's been a most outspoken atheist. And he wrote this book, The Delusion of God, back in 2005 or something like that. And in that, he likened Christianity to being this wicked, evil movement that has always created wickedness and evilness. And he identified Hitler as being a Christian in that book. Because Hitler claimed to be a Christian. Richard Dawkins is now coming out saying, Christianity may not be all that bad. It may be the only thing that makes any sense out of any of this. It may be the only thing capable of stopping it. Seemed to me like God must be at work in that man. Because he would have choked on his tongue before he was said that 10 years ago. But again, just remember how we wound up with a Great Commission last week. Christianity is about doing. It's not about sitting. It's about not about twiddling thumbs. It's not about just waiting. It's all about going. And it's all about doing. For the right reasons. Doesn't God deserve that glory when people come to faith in him? Don't those people desperately need Jesus? It's easy for us to look around and point fingers at everybody else. But we must ultimately ask ourselves this question. How have I contributed to it myself? And what am I willing to do? Not out of guilt. Out of love. Love for the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. This is his show. And we're just little teeny tiny pieces of it. Scott had a friend die just a few weeks ago, and he was really wondering about his salvation for many, many years, and we were praying for him and all of that. And so he went, and his friend was dying from cancer, and so he went to him, and he talked with him, and he found out that the man had been converted within just a few weeks or maybe months of the time they last saw him. Just like the thief on the cross, guys, he stands as an eternal example of it's never too late. How many people out there are in the same boat today? How many people will die today without ever hearing the gospel from anybody? And let's face it, we're a people who are very concerned about convenience too. Our convenience. What's convenient for me? To stay, to sit, to go, to speak.